waiting for the copyright trial of the century? Well, you may be waiting a while. The Google Books case, first brought by the Authors Guild in 2005, had once received that billing. But court observers today expect the lawsuit will end soon and without an awful lot of hoopla. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Day's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. One of those court observers joins me now, just as he does every Friday from his office at Publishers Weekly. Andrew Albanese, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Hey there, Chris.
Well, indeed, you were in Judge Denny Chin's courtroom last week, and after 8 long years, it appears that that famous lawsuit, the Google Books case, is coming down to the final stretch.
Yes, it certainly does appear to be winding down, and as you suggested, seems to be also ending with a whimper rather than a bang. You can read my blow-by-blow account on the PW website about how the hearing went on Monday, but a few things jumped out at me, and the first is that the actual argument on the summary judgment motions on the fair use issue were over in less than 40 minutes. From gavel to gavel, just 40 minutes to hear this case. And as you say, like in 2005, this was really sort of set up to be the copyright trial of the century. But if this hearing does prove to be the end of the matter, it was, to say the least, anticlimactic. Of course, at the same time, after 8 years of litigation and 3 years stumping for a failed settlement, it's really no surprise that the court was so well aware of the issues that it really didn't need a longer argument. Another observation I would offer is that, yeah, this hearing is pretty much going to end the matter. At the hearing itself, Judge Chin specifically asked the parties whether or not there were any issues of fact that might require him to conduct a trial, or whether or not these summary judgment motions were going to do the trick. Google had no qualms. It was fair use or not fair use for them, so hey, no trial required. Authors Guild attorney Ned Rosenthal hedged a little bit, and there was an interesting little give and take about what was a question of law versus a question of fact. But in the end, Chin seemed pretty satisfied that he didn't have any fact issues. So get ready, folks. I think this is it. I think this is probably going to settle the matter. As for the arguments themselves, I think it's worth noting that Google attorney Darylin Dury, by my watch, spoke for about 5 minutes total. The Authors Guild attorney Ned Rosenthal had a bit of a tougher job. He tried to emphasize to the court that they should be looking more at Google's commercial model, that their search engine gained this great advantage over other search engines by copying material and not paying authors, rather than have the court look at how the search engine benefited the public and the authors themselves. But, Chin seemed pretty skeptical of that argument, and he spent the bulk of the hearing grilling Rosenthal pretty hard on these issues. And it was pretty clear to me, and to pretty much all the other observers that I was sitting with in the courtroom, that Chin definitely saw that there was some transformative element to the scanning and the scanning that Google did for searching and indexing. And he certainly did not seem to see any harm to the authors beyond the speculation that was offered by Rosenthal. Also, there was a legal issue that came up, and I didn't include this in my report because it was a little bit too legal, a little too inside baseball, but I'll talk with you a little bit about it here. And it seemed to verge basically on, to be kind, the Authors Guild might have botched their claim a little bit here. It involved the Guild's claim that Google distributed copies of the scanned books to libraries. Essentially, the Guild argument is that Google bought the books from the libraries, and they basically paid for them by giving scans back to those libraries in exchange for access to the material. However, the libraries ultimately made the copies themselves. In other words, they went onto Google's system, they took the scan, and they made the copy themselves. And the Guild actually acknowledged this at the hearing. The problem with that is that if you stipulate that the libraries made the copies themselves, then Google would only be on the hook for contributory infringement at best. But the Authors Guild suit does not allege contributory infringement, and they can't add it at this stage. So, whoops, kind of missed out on that one. But even more devastating, Judge Chin pointed out, Judge Baer already ruled in the HathiTrust case that the library uses were fair use. And, Chin is not likely going to take on that or dispute Judge Baer in this case. He's probably going to defer to Judge Baer. That's generally what happens in these cases. So, anyway, you slice it, one of the AG's key claims that Google distributed copies of books to libraries is essentially moot here, I think. Now, and finally, I was looking at the comments on the PW website, and I saw that our friend Robert Gottlieb from Trident Media criticized Judge Chin and branded him an activist judge. But I just want to add, no, not so much. And I want to point out that Chin is perhaps as skeptical as any judge you're going to find on the bench of Google's program. You know, for one, he approved of the guild's class action status, which was then overturned by the Second Circuit. And two, he dissented in a recent copyright victory for Aereo over Cablevision in what was essentially a rebroadcast case. So, in fact, Chin is very sympathetic to copyright owners. And he's pretty skeptical a lot of the digital stuff here, and that he appears to be leaning toward finding fair use in the Google case, I think speaks more to the strength of Google's fair use argument than it does to him being an activist judge.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating analysis, Andrew, and I think you make a great point. I mean, certainly we need to bear in mind that when he threw out the settlement a few years ago, he really left people thinking he didn't think much of this particular program, and he really was, as you say, sympathetic to the copyright holders.
Yeah, and he really does seem genuinely troubled by the fact that Google scanned all of this stuff, like wholesale, full copies, multiple copies in some cases, so they could have, you know, transactional copies, as they call them. He does seem to be wrestling with that a little bit. But certainly, I think he believes that his role is to balance how those copies are used versus the rights of the authors to control their works. And he certainly seems to be leaning towards finding it fair use.
Well, we'll have to wait for the final judgment there, but we expect it soon. Anyway, also this week, we learned that Penguin was getting back together with Overdrive to enable ebook lending. And as we see with almost everything ebook related, there's some news in there about Amazon, too.
That is correct. After nearly 2 years since Penguin pulled its ebook titles from Overdrive, which is the market leading library ebook lending service, Penguin titles are coming back. According to a statement released this week from Overdrive and confirmed by Penguin, more than 17,000 Penguin ebooks are again going to be available for purchase and for lending through Overdrive. The titles can be licensed for 1 year with front list titles to be priced at about $18.99 and backlist titles ranging from $5.99 to $9.99. And all that's pretty good news for libraries. In fact, libraries think that model is kind of good. In addition, Penguin will also expand its relationship with Baker & Taylor, making its ebooks available to all Baker & Taylor Access 360 customers. Baker & Taylor had been in a pilot mode since last fall with library systems in Los Angeles and Cleveland. So it's good news also that, you know, Penguin is moving that out of the pilot and expanding that to all libraries who want to participate. But there is a question that still sort of lingers. You know, what did dumping Overdrive for 2 years really achieve for Penguin? You know, and I've been trying to find out what, and I really, not much as far as I can tell. And notably, Penguin's return to Overdrive also included a measure that's going to add some friction for Kindle users. Now, our listeners may recall that it was Overdrive's exclusive deal to enable ebook lending to the Kindle that played a key part in Penguin's decision to sever its relationship with Overdrive in the first place. Penguin officials had cited murky security concerns. And although Penguin officials never really elaborated on what those security concerns would be, Overdrive officials told me at the time that there was no incident with Overdrive involving the security of any of its titles. None of its titles were ever compromised or in question. Rather, it seems that Penguin was simply not comfortable with how the Overdrive program sent library users to Amazon to complete the library lend. In essence, delivering library users and all the data that those library users generate to Amazon. So, in resuming its relationship with Overdrive, users are again, you know, they're going to be able to read Penguin Library books on the Kindle through Overdrive, but now they have to sideload those books through a USB connection from a computer directly to their devices. Over-the-air downloads are not going to be allowed for the Kindle. They are available for the Nook, for Kobo, for other devices that are compatible. But with the sideloading, it's interesting. Users are still sent to Amazon's site to complete the lend. They still have to sign in with their Kindle accounts to complete the sideload. And once you complete the sideload, the ebook is then synced with the Amazon cloud. So I really don't see what security concerns were alleviated here by not allowing over-the-air downloads of Kindle books. In fact, I think the sideload merely adds a level of inconvenience for library users who are reading on the Kindle. And I think that inconvenience is exactly the point. The major publishers, especially Penguin, have long expressed concern that library ebook borrowing lacks the friction of a traditional library market where physical books have to be picked up and returned, for example. And clearly, with Amazon still the dominant platform, publishers are wary of Kindle users getting used to borrowing books from their library
right from the comfort of their couch instead of having to buy it or at least go through some sort of process to buying it. So, you know, hence you can download your library books over to, you know, to your Nook, but not to your Kindle. Also of note, the recent merger between Penguin and Random House. Now, the publishers both say they're going to retain their individual ebook library lending practice for the time being. Random House, of course, offers its entire catalog for perpetual access to libraries, but it charges higher prices, as much as 3 times higher per ebook. And, you know, that really kind of makes sense to me that they would keep the two things separate for now. I mean, why not, right? You're one company, but you've got these two major brands that are both, you know, operating independently in the market. That seems like a good opportunity for the company to evaluate how both models work, see what works best, and maybe come up with a joint model sometime in the future.
Well, absolutely. And certainly one of the lessons of the internet and the digital age is to experiment and to try a few different things, because if you choose one particular path and only that path, you could be going down the wrong road.
Exactly. And I think it's good news also that at least Penguin is sort of, you know, back re-engaged in the ebook lending market after a rocky couple of years.
Well, indeed. And finally, you know, it all comes down to money. And this week in PW, we learned where the money is in publishing, or at least who's making the money.
Yeah, or where the money isn't in publishing, maybe we should
say. Right.
You know, that's right. You know, in Monday's issue, we're going to have a breakdown of a breakfast panel that we hosted at Random House on September 25th that's going to discuss our forthcoming salary and job survey. You know, I'll leave you with just a few highlights here. You know, the average raise in publishing was under 3%. That's kind of normal for publishing, and it's actually not too bad considering how bad the economy is, and a lot of people aren't getting raises at all if they're lucky enough to have those jobs in the first place. But still, you know, it's not going to be a shocker to anyone here that low salaries persist in publishing and that those low salaries are pretty much still the main driver of dissatisfaction people have with their jobs. So, you know, shocker, but low pay in publishing persists. But this year's survey is fascinating, and we'll have more on that in weeks to come. Because it went a little deeper to look at how those publishing jobs are changing. You know, one little thing I'll leave you with is that 74% of respondents said their employer had added new digital jobs, new digital-only jobs, I should say. You know, a whopping 64% said that they'd received no training at all in digital. You know, that they're mostly pretty much left to figure it out on their own, which many of them are doing. The survey also looks at the rise of social media and, you know, how we're using that to advance both publishing industry and how people are using it to advance their jobs. So, you know, more on that to come in the coming weeks. But check out Monday's issue for a neat little snapshot from the panel about where the industry is and how it's changing.
Well, I definitely want to have a look at the whole rise of social media and how that does have an impact on the job, because certainly it's changed my job.
It's changed my job as well. Absolutely.
All right. Andrew Albany, senior writer at Publishers Weekly, thanks so much for joining us on Beyond the Book.
And my pleasure as always.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. Follow us on Twitter, find Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at the Copyright Clearance Center website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.